This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, November 22nd of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, we'll share some of the details that have emerged about the attack on Club Q in Colorado Springs. Then we'll bring you the latest in our Follow the Waste series. This time, it's about contamination in the compost. And This Week in Water covers what is to be the largest dam removal and river restoration project in the world. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines. Then it's How on Earth. The Thanksgiving week edition of The Science Show examines holistic agriculture and regenerative grazing in particular. Their guests are the authors of the book Grass-Fed Beef for a Post-Pandemic World. At 9 a.m. comes another archival recording of British philosopher Alan Watts. Then at 9:30, Joanne Cole will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first it's time for headlines with KGNU's Luis Licon.
Hello and good morning. These are the morning headlines for KGNU. I am Luis Licon. Colorado Springs police identified on Monday the five victims of the mass shooting at Club Q. Their names are Kellen Loving, Daniel Aston, Derek Rump, Ashley Paul, and Raymond Green Vance. They range in age from 22 to 40 years old. According to Gun Violence Archive, there has been more than 600 mass shootings in the United States this year. We will have more details about the Club Q shooting later in the program. Former Arizona Congresswoman Gabby Giffords is applauding the formation of a new gun violence prevention caucus in the Colorado legislature. A spokeswoman for Giffords, who was wounded in the mass shooting in Arizona in 2011, said the formation of this caucus is a critical step in the fight to save lives. We look forward to continuing our work with the caucus to ensure the safety of communities throughout Colorado. Giffords, in partnership with state lawmakers from Colorado, plans to address gun violence and prioritize legislation that addresses gun violence with proven, equitable, and evidence-based solutions. The Denver Rescue Mission is putting a halt to an anti-LGBTQ language in its employee handbook. Stacey Johnson from KGNU has more.
The Denver Rescue Mission says it's removing language from its employee handbook that bars employees from acting on same-sex attraction and rejecting one's biological sex. Denverite reports that the mission released a statement Monday saying its board of directors and leadership have determined it is appropriate to reevaluate the recent changes and have since paused the language implementation. The organization currently has a $8.7 million contract with the City of Denver and the city's Housing Stability Unit to operate shelter services. The city's Housing Stability Unit also released a statement to Denverite that the city would not tolerate discrimination of services or employment operated under publicly funded contracts. ACLU Colorado Legal Director Mark Silverstein and Civil Rights Attorney Mari Newman, who helped write the state's anti-discrimination law, also told Denverite that they believe the handbook violates both state and federal law. Newman says there is an exemption for religious organizations doing ministry, but the exemption would not apply to the employees staffed by the Denver Rescue Mission. For KGNU, I'm Stacey Johnson.
Boulder-based nonprofit Feet Forward is providing free Thanksgiving meals for anyone in need this Thursday. Around 200 meals will be available at Boulder's Band Shell on Thanksgiving Day, beginning at 3 p.m. Feet Forward says it's the only area nonprofit offering warm Thanksgiving meals to those in need. The City of Lafayette has announced a new chief financial officer. Devin Billingsley, who has been the city's interim finance director since January, will take on the new post. He will be in charge of the city's cash flow, management of debt, producing annual financial reports, and producing the city's budget. Today we are expecting some cloudy conditions in the afternoon, with temperatures in Boulder in the high 50s and the low of 27, with a current temperature of 30 degrees. In Denver, there's going to be a high of 53 and a low of 24, with a current temperature of 26 degrees. In Fort Collins, there's going to be a high of 49 and a low of 20, with a current temperature of 23 degrees. For KGNU, I am Luis Ligon.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Authorities in Colorado Springs have released further details about Saturday night's armed attack on Club Q. Alexis Kenyon has more.
Among the new details released on Monday afternoon's media briefing were the names of those killed in the mass shooting. Colorado Springs Police Chief Adrian Vasquez said authorities were identifying the victims as they identified themselves. He read the names of the five individuals who died after the gunman entered a gay club in Colorado Springs on Saturday night and opened fire.
The first person I'll identify is Kelly Loving. Kelly's pronouns are she, her. Daniel Aston. Daniel's pronouns are he, him. Derek Rump. Derek's pronouns are he, him. Ashley Paugh, and that's P-A-U-G-H. Ashley's pronouns are she, her. Raymond Green Vance. Raymond's pronouns are he, him.
According to reports from clubgoers, the shooter opened fire shortly before midnight with what eyewitnesses say was a military-style gun. Police have identified the suspected attacker as a 22-year-old local man whose name matches that of a person with an arrest record for past threats of violence against his mother. The armed man shot close to 24 people before a retired Army veteran, hearing the shots, ran through the crowd, grabbed the gun, and struck the attacker with the weapon several times. A second club patron helped him subdue the shooter. The veteran, Richard Fierro, told the New York Times that he was at the club with his wife and daughter for the drag show. When he heard the shots, he went into survival mode. U.S. Attorney Cole Finnegan called Fierro heroic at Monday's media briefing.
I had the opportunity before I came here today to talk to Richard Fierro, identified as one of the two heroes that subdued the suspect in this case. And in my opinion, I think the opinion of everyone involved, saved a lot of lives. I have never encountered a person who had engaged in such heroic actions that was so humble about it. He simply said to me, I was trying to protect my family.
Since Saturday's shooting, many have called out the Colorado Springs Police Department for not enforcing Colorado's red flag law before the gunmen entered Club Q. El Paso County, where Colorado Springs is located, declared itself a Second Amendment sanctuary in 2019 after red flag laws passed across the country. Red flag laws allow law enforcement to remove guns from people deemed dangerous to themselves or others. Despite a past arrest for domestic violence, the shooter was able to acquire firearms. Chief of Police Adrian Vasquez said the department didn't have enough evidence to deem the suspect a threat.
If law enforcement has credible information that fits within the parameters of the red flag law, then we should take action on that. That's what the law is, and it allows us to do that, and we should take those actions. But as the mayor says, we have to have the right information, the probable cause. We have to have credible information to be able to do that. So if we do, then of course we should act on it.
In the meantime, some of the 17 gunshot victims remain in the hospital in critical condition. According to the U.S. attorney, no official charges have been filed against the suspect, who remains in the hospital. Authorities say they are continuing to investigate the shootings as a hate crime. They ask the public to submit any additional information or eyewitness video footage to aid in the ongoing investigation. For KGNU, I'm Alexis Kenyon.
The push to compost as much food waste as possible in Boulder County suffered a setback earlier this year. The largest composting facility on the Front Range started turning away truckloads of food waste due to contamination. Some of those trucks were carrying food from school cafeterias. As part of our Follow the Waste series, Sam Fuqua brings us this report on composting in the Boulder Valley schools.
It's a Wednesday afternoon in the produce washroom at the Boulder Valley School District's central kitchen. It smells like fresh celery.
So I've got some parsley and some green onions there that are going to be processed into the Mediterranean rice salad. And the celery here is going to be processed for our marinara sauce.
Barbara McLeod is a kitchen satellite lead for the district's food service department. She's part of a small team with a big job, 17,000 meals a day at over 50 schools. That's a lot of food and a lot of food waste. The district composted over 6 tons of it in October. McLeod puts the butt ends of the celery in a 5-gallon bucket at her feet. Those are bound for the kitchen's compost dumpster.
So this is our compost bin, our big dumpster where we put all of our food waste from the production kitchen.
Mary Rochelle is the communications and fundraising manager for the school district's food services department. We're looking over the edge of a loading dock into a dumpster full of peaches.
So right now it looks like we have some peaches that went moldy in our storage.
There are hundreds of peaches in this dumpster.
Right, so we have a lot of food that comes through our building, and it sometimes doesn't get out to schools in time, or it might arrive already kind of on the edge of turning.
Rochelle says nobody enjoys getting rid of these peaches, but it could be worse.
It's such a bummer to see food thrown away because, you know, these peaches were grown in Colorado. You know, we know there are local farmers who work really hard. So it's always a bummer to have food waste, but it's a much bigger bummer if it goes into a landfill.
So instead of rotting in a landfill, these peaches are going to rot in a compost pile. Kim Orr coordinates the school recycling and environmental education programs for local nonprofit EcoCycle. She says organic material in a landfill concentrates methane, a potent greenhouse gas. That type of concentration does not happen in composting.
In a landfill, it's an anaerobic situation where there's not a lot of oxygen present, and that's why the methane production is so much higher. Over the course of the landfill's lifetime, methane production spikes and stays that way throughout the rest of its lifetime. That doesn't occur in a compost pile. So if we can keep those organics out of the landfill, we're helping our environment immensely.
Plus, Orr says the finished product is an important contribution to healthy soil.
If we're composting them instead of landfilling them, we're creating healthy, valuable soil amendments for a state that has really crummy soils. And so if we can keep that valuable nutrient in the soil, we're going to grow nutrient-dense foods that keep humans healthy and our environment healthy too, as well as our soils being able to retain more water in a state that doesn't have a lot of water.
But to get good compost, you need clean food waste without a bunch of other stuff mixed in. That's been a growing problem for large-scale composting on the Front Range. The school district's Mary Rochelle says she saw the problem when she obtained some compost for her own garden.
So this spring, before any of this came up, I got compost for the garden beds in my community garden. You know, I got buckets of it and put it in my garden, and we started spreading it out. And my partner and I were just kind of horrified at the amount of glass and plastic and trash that was in the compost that we were putting into our garden.
We find a lot of contamination in the front of the house, commercial and residential stream.
Clinton Sander is the marketing manager for A1 Organics, based in Keensburg, about an hour east of Boulder. They run the largest composting operation in the state. Earlier this year, A1 started turning away loads of compostable food waste, including from the Boulder Valley School District and from businesses in Boulder.
We have realized that the contamination is increasing to the point where we can't manage it on our site. We do have some really amazing equipment out there that help remove contaminants, you know, but we can't get it all out. And we've actually had a lot of expense this year in return product or debris management on the site.
So just before the start of this school year, EcoCycle and the school district got word that A1 Organics had a new zero tolerance policy for contaminated compost. The school district stopped asking students to compost their lunchtime food waste in the cafeterias. They still collect compost from the school kitchens and the central facility, like that dumpster full of peaches. But the 41 schools that used to ask students to compost their leftover lunches no longer do so. Food service staffer Barbara McLeod says it's no surprise that sometimes other items get thrown in with the food waste.
Lunchtimes are pretty hectic, and those kids are in and out as fast as they can be. And I think that a lot of times when they are, you know, just bussing their trays at the end of lunch, forks get missed or plasticware. You know, it's a great program for the students to understand where their food waste is going, but unfortunately, unless there's somebody there to police it, sometimes things just get missed. So,
have a great lunch.
Chicken ramen bowl, mac and cheese, and a fresh salad bar are all on the menu here at Southern Hills Middle School in South Boulder. While they wait in the lunch line, many of the students are not shy about sharing their opinions on the change in food waste collection. Kate says it was hard for some students to get it right.
It was too difficult because all the kids would throw all their plastic in there and all their like non-compostable like containers, plastic bags, everything. And so they just couldn't sort through all of that.
Annie says better signage would help kids understand what can and cannot be composted.
If they had like signs that were like compost, these are the things you should compost. And then you would know what to put in the bin because it just takes an extra 5 seconds if you know what you're supposed to put in there.
Leo and Nate just wish the compost bin would come back.
It's really wasteful because it used to go to useful places where they could make dirt out of it and help to grow more food. But now it's just nothing.
It might have been hard for some people to understand, but it helps save our environment. And I would rather have some people throwing stuff in the compost and saving our environment than having everything go to the trash.
The end of cafeteria composting cut the district's compost numbers almost in half. Numbers from EcoCycle show that in October, the district still collected almost 13,000 pounds of food waste, but that's a sharp decline from almost 24,000 pounds back in October 2019. That was a pre-pandemic time when most school cafeterias were asking students to compost. Like the students, the school district staff also wants to bring back the cafeteria composting. Gita Carroll oversees a wide range of sustainability issues for the Boulder Valley School District.
We would love to bring it back to the cafeteria. I think we would need to make sure that we had staff or students or green teams, which we know exist in our schools, monitoring that waste collection. So that's a big part of it, is having somebody there can answer questions, because even people with the best intentions make mistakes.
Carroll says there's no specific timeline for returning composting to Boulder Valley School cafeterias, but the district wants to be part of the community-wide effort to help make clean compost.
We also really want to be working with the community to try to figure this out so that the schools are in line with what's happening, with what people are seeing at restaurants and at their home and everywhere else. We don't want to be making any of these decisions in a silo. We want to be kind of supporting the community effort around zero waste and trying to figure out the best way to move forward.
Because of compost contamination, the city of Boulder also dropped a requirement that food businesses have a compost bin in their public space. It's possible the kids in the schools will figure it out faster and get back to composting before the grown-ups do. For KGNU, I'm Sam Fuqua in Boulder.
KGNU's Follow the Waste reporting series was made possible by a grant from Boulder County's Zero Waste Funding Program. Time now for This Week in Water with H2O Radio's Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
Four dams are coming down. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Some are calling the agreement historic, but others are deeply disappointed.
On Friday, November 18th, as the COP27 climate conference in Egypt was set to end, it looked like there would be no consensus. But 2 days later, after intense negotiating, an agreement was reached.
For the first time ever, delegates pledged to set up a fund to help vulnerable nations deal with the loss and damage from climate change. For decades, island countries and others like Bangladesh have demanded compensation from those most responsible for global warming.
But there was no progress on goals to rapidly limit greenhouse gas emissions amidst much disagreement on the details. The final document only repeats last year's promise to phase down the use of unabated coal, coal from which CO2 emissions have not been mitigated or captured.
The phase-out of all fossil fuels was resisted by China and Saudi Arabia, as well as African nations that see opportunity in developing oil and gas.
Parts of the COP27 document are weaker than previous agreements. For example, a section on the energy sector that in the past said renewables should be increased now only talks about low-emission energy, which could allow the continuing use of natural gas.
About 150 countries agreed to the Global Methane Pledge, an initiative to cut emissions of the powerful greenhouse gas. The measure targets leaks as well as flaming and venting from gas operations.
It will be the largest dam removal and river restoration project in the world, and it could begin in just a few months.
The federal government has approved demolishing 4 hydroelectric dams on the Klamath River along California's border with Oregon that will result in its free flow for the first time in more than a century.
It's a major victory for Native American tribes in Northern California and also for environmental and fishing groups, not to mention salmon and steelhead, whose numbers have dwindled. The river and its bounty have been tied to the tribe's economic, spiritual, and cultural lives for centuries.
The decision by the federal government to decommission the dams was based upon its estimate that the structures would lose millions of dollars per year if they were kept in operation. The dams don't supply irrigation water, but do provide electricity to 70,000 people.
Opening up the river and its tributaries will provide more than 300 miles of habitat for salmon and allow the Klamath, California's second largest river, to flow naturally, restoring floodplains and wetlands that will mitigate the effects of drought.
The demolition of the 4 dams comes after much opposition from Republican lawmakers, among others. Some say removing the dams won't save the salmon, and others worry rural counties will have to pay increased rates for power.
If you live in Atlanta, Georgia, Orange County, California, or Aurora, Colorado, some of your drinking water is potable reuse, meaning it's purified wastewater. But before you wince, according to a new study from Stanford, it could be cleaner than conventionally treated water.
The researchers say that's because regulators demand more from potable reuse treatment plants to remove harmful pathogens. So operators employ reverse osmosis, biofiltration, and other methods to flush out contaminants.
And the scientists say that makes potable reuse less toxic than some water supplies sourced from rivers, which can contain wastewater from an upstream treatment plant that doesn't clean to the level of recycled water and might contain chemicals from shampoos to medicines.
Also, the EPA regulates a slew of chemicals in drinking water, but some dangerous compounds might not yet be known and therefore not removed.
As climate change reduces snowpack, potable reuse is being seen as more reliable and a supply that utilities already possess. That means more water can stay in ecosystems, and less wastewater, along with its contaminants, will be discharged into rivers. And finally, e-waste is a growing problem, with some 50 million metric tons of discarded electronic devices getting chucked into landfills every year, where they leach toxic chemicals into soils and water instead of being recycled into new products.
But what if electronics were developed with their complete life cycle in mind, so that when they outlive their usefulness, they biodegrade? That's the idea behind Myceliotronics, a material made from mushrooms that can be used to make computer chips.
Researchers in Austria were studying a mushroom that grows on dead hardwood trees for its potential use in insulation. They discovered that its root-like structure called mycelium had a protective skin to ward off pathogens and bacteria.
They found that when they peeled and dried the skin, it could withstand high temperatures and was extremely flexible, not breaking even after being bent 2,000 times. That made the mycelium skin an ideal material for the base of the computer chips, rather than the unrecycled plastic that's currently used.
Better still, the mycelium skin stays durable so long as it's kept dry and away from light, but if composted, it degrades in just a few weeks.
While the research is still in its early stages, it looks like the idea of using mycelium to make greener electronics could mushroom.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. Thanks to Luis Licon, John Kellen, Stacey Johnson, Azucena Flores, Alexis Kenyon, Sam Fuqua, Jamie Sudler, and Franny Halperin for their contributions to today's program. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Stay tuned for How on Earth. That's coming up just after the news headlines from the BBC.